Chapter 14. Anmurat. It is the difference in knowledge that commands respect. This is why the true test of every student lies in the humiliation of his master. Gotaga, the Prima Arcanata. The children here play with bones instead of sticks, and whenever I see them, I cannot but wonder whether the humeri they brandish are faithful or heathen. Heathen, I should think, for the bones seem bent. Anonymous. Letter from Anmurat. Late summer, 4111, year of the Tusk, Shigek. Reviewing the latest intelligence reports, Icuri Confis let Martimus stand unacknowledged for several moments. The canvas walls of his command pavilion had been rolled up and bound to facilitate traffic. Officers, messengers, secretaries, and scribes shuttled back and forth between the lamp-illumined interior and the surrounding darkness of the Nansur encampment. Men called out and muttered in deliberation, their faces almost uniformly blank, their eyes slack with a wary expectancy of battle. They were Nansur, and no people had lost more sons to the Fenim. Such a battle, and he, the Lion of Kayuth, would be little more than a subaltern. No matter. It would be salt for the honey, as the Ainani were fond of saying, the bitterness that made vengeance sweet.
When dawn breaks and the Skilvendi dog leads us into battle, Confis said, still studying the documents fanned across the table before him, I've decided that you, Martimus, will be my representative.
Do you have any specific instructions? The general asked stiffly.
Confis looked up, appraised the hard-jawed man for several condescending moments. Why had he allowed him to keep his blue general's cloak? He should have sold the fool to the slavers.
You think I give you this charge because I trust you to the degree I distrust the Skilvendi, but you're wrong. As much as I despise the savage, as much as I intend to see him dead, I do in fact trust him in matters of war.
And well he should, Confis mused. As strange as it seemed, the barbarian had been his student for quite some time, since the Battle of Kayuth, if not longer. No wonder they called fate a whore.
But you, Martimus, Confis continued, you I scarcely trust at all.
Then why give me such an assignment?
No protestations of innocence, no hurt looks or clenched fists, only stoic curiosity. For all his failings, Confis realized, Martimus remained a remarkable man. It would be such a waste.
Because you've unfinished business.
Confis handed several sheets to his secretary, then looked down as though to study the next sheaf of parchment.
I've just been told the Prince of Atrathau accompanies the Skilvendi.
He graced the general with a dazzling smile. Martimus said nothing for a stone-faced moment.
But I told you, he's...
Please, Confis snapped. How long has it been since you've drawn your sword, hm? If I doubt your loyalty, I laugh at your prowess.
No, you'll only observe.
Then who? But Confis had already waved the three men forward, the assassins dispatched by his uncle. The two, who were obviously Nansur, weren't all that imposing, perhaps, but the third, the black-skinned Zayumi, drew nervous glances from even the most distracted of Confis's officers. He towered a full head above the surrounding mob, bull-chested and yellow-eyed. He wore the red-striped tunic and iron-scale harness of an imperial auxiliary, though a great tulwar hung across his back. A Zayumi sword dancer. The Emperor had been generous indeed.
These men, Confis said, staring hard at the general, will do the work.
He leaned forward, lowering his voice so as not to be overheard.
But you, Martimus, you'll be the one who brings me Anasarimba Kellis's head.
Was that horror he saw in the man's eyes, or was it hope? Confis fell back into his chair.
You can use your cloak as a sack.
The long howl of Enrithi horns pierced the pre-dawn gloom, and the men of the Tusk arose certain of their triumph. They stood on the south bank. They had met their enemy before and had crushed him. They would enter battle with all of their assembled might, and most importantly, the god himself walked among them. They could see him in thousands of bright eyes. Spears and lances had become, it seemed to them, markers of the tusk. The air was rifled by the commanding cries of thanes, barons, and their major domos. Men hastened into their gear. Horsemen streamed between the tents. Armored men knelt in circles, praying. Wine was passed, bread hastily broken and devoured. Bands of men drifted to their places in the line, some singing, some watchful. Small groups of wives and prostitutes waved hands and colored scarves at passing troops of mounted warriors. Priests intoned the most profound benedictions. By the time the sun gilded the Menenor, the Enrithi had assembled in rank after glorious rank across the fields. Several hundred paces away, an immense arc of silvered armor, brilliant coats, and stamping horses awaited them. From the southern heights to the dark Sempus, the Fenum encompassed the horizon. Great divisions of horsemen trotted across the northern pastures. Arms flashed from the walls and turrets of Anwarat. Deep formations of spearmen darkened the shallow embankments to the south. More horsemen massed across the southern hilltops, following the heights to the sea. Every distance, it seemed, bristled with heathen. The Enrithi line seethed with the habits and hatreds of its constituent nations. The unruly Galioth, hurling insults and jeering reminders of earlier slaughter. The magnificent knights of Conraya, hollering curses through silvered war masks. The glaring Thonieri, swearing oaths of blood to their shield brothers. The disciplined Nansur, standing immobile, keen to the calls of their officers. The Shrial knights, eyeing the skies, their lips tight with fervent prayer. The haughty Einani, anxious and impassive behind the white cosmetics of war. The black-armored ranks of Taidoni, taking sullen measure of the mongrels they were about to kill. 100 banners fluttered in the morning wind. What was this trade he had made? War for a woman? With Kellis at his side, Nayor led a small army of officers, observers, and field messengers up turf and gravel ramps to the summit of a small hillock dominating the central pastures. Proyas had provided him slaves, and they hastened to prepare his command, unloading trestles from the wains, pitching canopies, and laying mats upon the ground. They raised his ad hoc standard, 2 bolts of white silk, each banded with lateral stripes of red, and flanked by horsetails that swished in the seaborne breeze. The Enrithi were already calling it the Swazon standard, the mark of their battlemaster. Nayur rode to the summit's edge and stared in wonder. Beneath him, sweeping out in either direction, the holy war darkened the woolen distances. Great squares and mobs of infantrymen, files and lines of burnished knights. Facing them, the heathen ranks scrawled along the hills and opposing fields, twinkling in the morning sun. Just small enough to obscure with 2 fingers, the fortress of Anwarat reared in the near distance, its walls and parapets adorned with long saffron banners. The air thrummed with the din of innumerable shouts. The faint peal of faraway battle horns was overpowered by the strident blare of those more near. Nayor breathed deep, smelled sea, desert, and dank river. Nothing of the absurd spectacle before him. If he closed his eyes and covered his ears, he thought, he could pretend he was alone.
I am of the land.
He dismounted, contemptuously thrust his reins to the Dunyane. Staring across the plains, he searched for weaknesses in the Enrithi disposition. Beyond a mile, their standards became little more than snags in the tatting of their ranks, so he could only assume the farther great names had arrayed their formations as discussed. The Einani, especially, on the extreme south, looked little more than dark fields aligned along the lower slopes of the coastal hills. He pinched his eyes, stiffened in sudden awareness of Kellis at his side. The man wore a white samite robe, cinched into a tail in the Conryan style, which is to say at the small of his back, so that his waist and legs remained unencumbered. Beneath, he sported a corselet of Kianine manufacture, probably looted from the battle plane, and the pleated kilt of a Conryan knight. His battle cap was Nansur, open-faced, without so much as a nose bar. As always, the long pommel of his sword jutted above his left shoulder. Two crude-looking knives, their hilts worked with Thunieri animal devices, had been thrust into his leather girdle. On the right breast of his robe, someone had embroidered the red tusk of the Holy War. Neyur's skin prickled at the nearness of him. What was this trade he had made? Never had Neyur suffered a night like the night previous. Why, he'd screamed at the Menenor, why had he agreed to teach the Dunyane war? War for Serwe, for a bauble found on the steppe, for nothing? He'd traded many things over the past months. Honor for the promise of vengeance, leather for effeminate silks, his yaksh for a prince's pavilion, the utamot in their unwashed hundreds for the enrithi in their hundreds of thousands. Battle master, king of tribes. Part of him reeled in drunken exultation at the thought. Such a host! From the river to the hills, a distance of almost 7 miles, and still the ranks ran deep. The people could never assemble such a horde, not if they emptied every yaksh, saddled every boy. And here, he, Neyur Ur-Skiotha, breaker of horses and men, commanded. Outland princes, earls and palatines, thanes and barons in their thousands, even an exalt general answer to him. Icuri Confus, the hated author of Kaiyuth. What would the people think? Would they call this glory? Or would they spit and curse his name, give him to the torments of the aged and infirm? But wasn't all war, all battle, holy? Wasn't victory the mark of the righteous? If he crushed the Fainim, ground them beneath the heel of his boot, what would the people think of his trade then? Would they finally say, this man, this many-blooded man, is truly of the land? Or would they whisper as they always whispered? Would they laugh as they always laughed? Yours is the name of our shame. What if he made a gift of the Enrithi? What if he delivered them to destruction? What if he rode home with Icuri Confus's head in a sack?
Skilvendi,
Moengus said from his side. That voice. Neyur looked at Kellis, blinking. Scorus, the Dunyane's look shouted. Scorus is our foe here. Neyur turned to the expectant Enrithi behind him. He could hear them muttering. With the exception of Proyas, each of the great names had sent representatives. To keep watch as much as to dispense advice, Neyur imagined. He recognized many of them from the councils of the great and lesser names. Thane Genrica, General Martimus, Baron Mimarapal, others. For some reason, a great hollow opened in his belly.
I must concentrate. Scorus is the foe here.
He spat across the dusty grass. Everything was at the ready. The Enrithi had assembled with a swiftness and exactitude that heartened. Scorus had deployed precisely as Neyur had expected. There was nothing more to be done, yet.
More time. I need more time.
But he had no time. War had come, and he'd agreed to yield its secrets in exchange for Serwe. He'd agreed to surrender the last shred of leverage he possessed. After this, he would have nothing to secure his vengeance. Nothing. After this, there would be no reason for Kellis to keep him alive.
I'm a threat to him. The only man who knows his secret.
So what was she that he'd doom himself for her? What was she that he would trade war?
Something is wrong with me. Something. No. Nothing. Nothing. Signal the general advance,
he barked, turning back to the field. A chorus of excited voices erupted behind him. Horns soon clawed at the sky. Kellis fixed him with shining, empty eyes. But Neyur had already looked away, back to the sweep of the west and to the great lines and squares of the Holy War sprawled across it. Long rows of armored horsemen were beginning to trot forward, followed by deeper ranks of footmen, walking with the speed with which one might greet a friend. Perhaps half a mile distant, The Phanum awaited them across the depths and the heights, holding tight their stamping thoroughbreds, hunching behind shield and spear. The pounding of their drums rumbled down from the hills. The Dunyane loomed in his periphery, as sharp as a mortal rebuke. What was this trade he had made? A woman for war.
Something is wrong.
Behind him, the Enrithi lords began singing. Along the entirety of the line, the Enrithi knights quickly outpaced the men-at-arms. Hares darted from copses, raced across the parched turf. Shod hooves made hash of desiccated weeds. Soon the men of the Tusk sailed across the uneven pasture, trailing immense skirts of dust. The sky was darkened by heathen arrows. Horses shrieked, tumbled. Armored men rolled across the turf and were trampled by their kin. But the men of the Tusk combed the fields with thundering hooves. Bobbing lance tips sketched circles around the nearing wall of heathen, who barbed the distance like a hedge of silvered thorns. Hatred clamped tooth to tooth. War shouts became howls of ecstasy. Heart and limb hummed with rapture. Could anything be so clear, so pure? Outstretched like great, fluid arms, the holy warriors embraced their enemy. The sermon was simple. Break. Die. Serwe was utterly alone. She'd avoided the company of the priests and other women who'd gathered in prayer at various points throughout the encampment. She'd already prayed to her god. She'd kissed him and had wept as he'd ridden off to join the Skilvendi. She sat before their fire pit, boiling water for the tea prescribed by Proyas's physician priest. Her tanned arms and shoulders burned in the rising sun. There was sand beneath the thin grass, and she could feel its grit chafe the soft skin behind her knees. The pavilion billowed and snapped like a ship's sail in the wind, a strange song, with random crescendo and meaningless pause. She wasn't afraid, but she was afflicted by competing confusions. Why must he risk himself? The loss of a Commune had filled her with pity for Esmanet and with fear for herself. Until his disappearance, it hadn't seemed she lived in the midst of a war. It had been more like a pilgrimage, not one where the faithful travel to visit something sacred, but rather one where people travel to deliver something holy, to deliver Kellis. But if a Commune, a great sorcerer, could vanish, become a casualty, might not Kellis vanish also? But this thought didn't so much frighten her. The possibility was too unthinkable, as it confused her. One cannot fear for a god, but one can be baffled over whether one should. Gods could die. The Skilvendi worshipped a dead god. Does Kellis fear? That, too, was unimaginable. She thought she heard something, a shadow, behind her, but her water had begun to boil. She stood to retrieve the crude kettle with clumsy sticks. How she missed Zynemus's slaves. She managed to set it on the turf without burning herself, a minor miracle. She stood, sighing and rubbing her lower back, when a warm hand reached around her and clutched her growing belly. Kellis! Smiling, she half-turned, pressed her cheek to his chest, and hooked a hand about his neck. What are you doing? She laughed and frowned. He seemed shorter. Did he stand in a hole? Warring is hungry business, Serwe. Certain appetites must be attended. Serwe blushed and wondered yet again that he had chosen her. Her? I bear his child. Now? She murmured. What of the battle? Don't you worry? His eyes laughing, he drew her toward the entrance of their pavilion. I worry for you. His Enrithi retinue chattered and cheered behind him. Different voices cried, Look! Look! Everywhere Neyur turned, he saw glory and horror. To his right, waves of Galioth and Tidoni galloped across the northern pastures into masses of Kianine horsemen. Before him, thousands of Kunrayan knights raced beneath the peril of Anwarat's heights. To his immediate left, the Thunieri, and beyond them, the Nansur columns, marched inexorably westward. Only the extreme south, obscured by curtains of dust, remained inscrutable. His heart quickened, his breath sharpened.
Too fast! Everything happens too fast!
Sauban and Gothjelk scattered the Fainim, pursued them hard through swirling grit. Proyas, flanked by hundreds of mail-armored knights, crashed into the bristling ranks of an immense Shigeki phalanx. His footmen had charged into his wake, and now thronged about Anrarat's southern bastions, bearing mantlets and great iron-headed ladders. Archers raked the parapets in volleys, while trains of men and oxen dragged assorted siege engines into position. Skyelt and Confis advanced across the pasture to the south, holding their horses in reserve. A series of earthen embankments, shallow but too sharp for charging horses, stepped the fields before them. As Nayor had guessed, the Sapatashah had massed his Shigeki conscripts along them. The position might have rendered Scaurus's entire center immune to attack had not Nayor ordered several hundred rafts dragged from the marshes and dispersed among the Thunieri and Nansur. Even now, in a hail of spears and javelins, the Nansur were raising the first of them as improvised ramps. General Setpenaris and his tens of thousands of Ainani knights remained hidden. Nayor could see the rearmost infantry phalanxes. They were little more than the shadows of squares at this distance, but nothing more.
Already the dogs gnaw at my gut.
He glanced at Kellis.
Since Scaurus has secured his flanks using the land, he explained, this battle will be one of Yertrut, penetration, not one of Unswaza, envelopment. Hosts, like men, prefer to face their enemy. Circumvent or break their lines, assault them from the flank or the rear.
He let his voice trail. The wind had thinned the dust to near transparency across the southern hills. Peering, he could see threads of what must be Ainani knights, withdrawing all along their 2-mile section of line. They seemed to be reforming on the slopes. Behind them, the many bars and squares of Ainani infantry had stalled. The Kianin still held the heights.
I should have given the Ainani the center. Who has Scaurus positioned there? Imbeyan? Swarjuka?
And this, Kellis asked, is how you crush your foe?
What?
By assaulting their flank or rear? Nayor shook his black mane.
No, this is how you convince your foe.
Convince? Nayor snorted.
This war, he snapped in Skilvendi. It's simply your war, made honest.
Kellis acknowledged nothing. Belief, you're saying battle is a disputation of belief, an argument. Nayor squinted, peered once more toward the south.
The memorialists call battle Otge Utmaga, a great quarrel. Both hosts take the field believing they are the victors. One host must be disabused of that belief, attacking his flank or his rear, overawing him, bewildering him, shocking him, killing him. These are all arguments meant to convince your foe he is defeated. He who believes he is defeated is defeated.
So, in battle, Kellis said, conviction makes true.
As I said, it is honest. Scaurus, I must concentrate upon Scaurus.
Overcome by a sudden restlessness, Nayor tugged at his mail harness as though plagued by a pinch. Barking several brief commands, he dispatched a rider to General Setpenaris. He needed to know who'd beaten the Ainani back from the hilltops, though by the time the man returned, Nayor knew, the battle would likely be decided. Then he ordered the hornsmen to remind the general to secure his flanks. Out of expediency, they'd adopted the Nansur mode of communication, with batteries of trumpeters stationed about the field, relaying coded numbers that corresponded to a handful of different warnings and commands. Though the Ainani general struck him as solid, his king regent, Keferamuni, was a rank fool. And the Ainani were a vain and effeminate race, something Scaurus wouldn't overlook. Nayor glanced at the Nansur and the Thunieri. The farther columns, those adjacent to the Ainani, appeared to be storming up their ramps already. Closer, where he could actually distinguish individual men, the first of the rafts were slamming into place, Wherever they fell, several Shigeki vanished, crushed. The first of the Thunieri charged forward, howling. Meanwhile, Proyas and his stalwarts waded through disintegrating ranks of Shigeki. Sunlight flashed from their threshing swords. But farther west, beyond the mud-brick village and dark orchards to the immediate rear of the Shigeki, Neyur could see distant lines of approaching horsemen. Scaurus's reserves, he imagined. He couldn't discern any of their devices through the haze, but their numbers looked worrisome. He dispatched a messenger to warn the Kunraians.
Everything goes to plan.
Neyur had known the Shigeki flanking Anruat would collapse before the fury of Proyas's charge. And Scaurus, he assumed, had also known. The question was one of whom the Sapatashah would send into the breach.
Probably Imbeyan.
Then he glanced to the north, to the open fields, where the Fainim horsemen had fallen back before Gathyelk and Sauban, taking high-walled Anruat as their implacable hinge.
See how Scaurus frustrates Sauban, he said.
Kellis searched the pastures and nodded. He doesn't contest so much as delay.
He concedes the north. The Galioth and Tidoni knights possess the advantage of Gewot, of Shok. But the Kianin possess the advantages of Utmortzu, cohesion, and Fira, speed. Though the Fainim cannot withstand the Inriti charge, they are quick enough and cohesive enough to execute the Malk Unswaza, the defense of envelopment.
Even as he said this, he saw streamers of hard-riding Kianin sluice around the Northmen. Kellis nodded, his eyes fixed on the distant drama. When the attacker overcommits on the charge, he risks exposing his flanks.
Which the Inriti usually do. Only their superior Ngutma, Hart, saves them.
Inriti knights stood their ground, suddenly beset on all sides. Some distance away, the Galioth and Tidoni infantry continued to trudge forward. Their conviction, Kellis said.
Neyur nodded. When the memorialists counsel the chieftains before battle, they bid them recall that in conflict all men are bound to one another, some by chains, some by ropes, and some by strings, all of different lengths. They call these bindings the Miuta Fury, the ligaments of war. These are just ways of describing the strength and flexibility of a formation's Ngotma. Those Kianin, the people would call Trutogarutut, men of the long chain. They can be thrown apart, but they will pull themselves together. The Galioth and Tidoni we would call Trutohirutut, men of the short chain. Left alone, such men would battle and battle. Only disaster or Utgirkoi, attrition, can break the chains of such men.
As they watched, the Fainim scattered before the long swords of the Norserai knights, drawing back to reform even farther to the west.
The leader, Neyur continued, must continually appraise and reappraise the string, rope, and chain of his enemy and his men.
So the north doesn't worry you?
No.
Neyur whirled southward, struck by an inexplicable apprehension of doom. The Ainani knights appeared to have retired for some reason, though too much dust still obscured the heights to be certain. The infantry had resumed their climb all along the line. He dispatched messengers to Confis, bidding him to send his Kidrahil to the Ainani rear. He ordered the hornsmen to signal Gotian.
There, he said to Kellis. Do you see the Ainani infantry advance?
Yes. Certain formations seem to drift to the right.
Without knowing, men will lean into the shield of the man to their right, seeking protection. When the Fainim charge to meet them, they will concentrate on those units. Watch.
Because they betray weaknesses in discipline.
Yes, depending on who leads. If Confis were directing them, I would say they drift right purposefully, to draw the Kianin away from his less experienced formations.
Deception. Neyur clutched his iron-plated girdle tight. A tremor had passed through his hands.
Everything goes to plan. Know what your enemy knows, he said,
hiding his face in the distance.
The ligaments must be defended as fiercely as they are attacked. Use knowledge of your enemy, deception, terrain, even harangues or examples of valor to guard and guard vigorously. Tolerate no disbelief. Fortify your host against it, and punish all instances with torture and death.
What's Setpanaris doing?
Because it spreads, Kellis said.
The people, Naor replied, have many stories of Nansur Columns perishing to the man. The hearts of some men never break, but most look to others for what to believe.
And this is rout, the loss of all conviction, what we witnessed on the battle plain. Naor nodded.
This is why Namturu, vigilance, is a leader's greatest virtue. The field must be continually read. The signs must be judged and rejudged. The Gobozkoi must not be missed.
The moment of decision. Naor scowled, remembering that he'd mentioned the term in passing months ago, at the fateful council with the Emperor on the Andiamine Heights.
The moment of decision, he repeated.
He continued staring at the coastal hills, watching the long line of faint infantry squares ascend the distant slopes. General Setpanaris had withdrawn his horse. But why? Save the south, the Phanum relented on every front. What plagued him so? Naor glanced at Kellis, saw his shining eyes study the distances the way they so often scrutinized souls. A gust cast his hair forward across his lower face.
I fear, the Dunyane said, the moment has already passed.
Between her cries, Serwe heard the peal of battle horns.
How?
She gasped. She lay on her side, her face buried in the cushions where Kellis had thrust it. He plumbed her from behind, his chest a furnace across her back, his hand holding her knee high. How different he felt.
How what, sweet Serwe?
He pressed deep and she moaned.
So different, she breathed. You feel so different. For you, sweet Serwe, for you.
For her. She ground against him, savored his difference.
Yes,
she hissed. He rolled onto his back, pulling her onto him. He traced the ivory summit of her belly with his haloed left hand, then reached down to make her cry out. With his right, he yanked her head up by her hair, turned her so he could mutter in her ear. Never had he used her like this.
Talk to me, sweet Serwe. Your voice is as sweet as your peach.
What? She panted. What would you have me say? He reached down, lifted her buttocks from his hips, effortlessly, as though she were a coin. He began thrusting, slow and deep.
Speak of me.
Kellis, she moaned.
I love you. I worship you. I do. I do. I do.
And why, sweet Serwe?
Because you're the God incarnate. Because you've been sent.
He fell absolutely still, knowing he'd delivered her to the humming brink. She gasped for air upon him, felt his heart pound against her spine and through his member, thrum like a bowstring. Through fluttering lashes, she gazed up at the geometry of canvas creases, watched the lines bend and refract through joyous tears. She encompassed him. To his foundation, he was hers. The mere thought made the air between her thighs thicken until every draft seemed palpable, like something twitching. She cried out, such rapture, such sweet rapture.
Sejanus!
And the Skilvendi, he purred, his voice moist with promise. Why does he despise me so?
Because he fears you,
she mumbled, squirming against him.
Because he knows you'll punish him.
He began moving again, but with infernal wariness. She squealed, clenched her teeth, marveled at the wonder of his difference. He even smelled different. Like... His hand closed about the back of her neck. How she loved this game. And why does he call me Dunyane?
What do you mean?
Naor said to the Dunyane.
Nothing has been decided. Nothing! He tries to deceive me, to undermine me before these outlanders.
Kellis regarded him with utter dispassion. I've studied the Book of Devices, the Nansor Manual describing the various personages and their signs in the Kianin order of—
As have I!
The illuminated pages, anyway. Nayur couldn't read. Most of the devices lie too far to be seen, Kellis continued. But I've been able to infer the identity of most—
Lies, lies, he fears I grow too powerful. How?
Nayur fairly cried. Differing shapes. The manual includes lists of each Sapatasha's client grandees. I simply counted. Nayur swept out his hand as though beating the air of flies.
Then who faces the Enonai?
Overlooking the Menenor, Imbeyan with the grandees of Anathpania. Swarjuka of Jurisada occupies the remaining heights. Dunjaksha and the grandees of Holy Amotu hold the descending ground opposite the Enonai right and Nansur left. The Shigeki, the center. Even though Scaldus' standard flies from Anwarat, I believe his grandees, along with Ansaser and the other survivors of the battle plane, contest the northern pastures. Those horsemen beyond the village, the ones about to descend upon Proyas, likely belong to Kuaksaji and the grandees of Kamema. Others ride with him, auxiliaries or allies of some kind. Likely the Kurgui. Many ride camels. Nayur stared incredulously at the man, his jaw working.
But that is impossible.
Where was Crown Prince Fenile and the feared Koyari? Where was Dread Kinganjahoy and the famed 10,000 grandees of Umarna? It's fact, Kellis said. Only a fraction of Kian stands before us. Nayur jerked his gaze yet again to the southern hills and knew from heart to marrow that the Dunyane spoke true. Suddenly he saw the field through Kianin eyes, the fleet grandees of Shigek and Gedea drawing the Tidoni and Galioth ever farther west, the Shigeki multitude dying as they should and fleeing as everyone knew they would. Anwarat, an immovable point threatening the Enrithi rear, then the southern hills.
He shows us. Nayur murmured. Scaldus shows us.
Two armies, Kellis said without hesitation. One defending, one concealed, the same as on the battle plane. Just then, Nayur saw the first long threads of Kianin horsemen descend the faraway southern slopes. Skirts of dust billowed behind them, obscuring the threads that followed. Even from here he could see the Enonai infantrymen bracing, miles of them. The Nansur and Thunyeri, meanwhile, had charged and hacked their way past the final embankments. The Shigeki ranks dissolved before their onslaught. Innumerable thousands already fled westward, pursued by battle-crazed Thunyeri. The Enrithi officers and caste nobles behind Nayur and Kellis broke into full-throated cheers. The fools. Scaldus need not fight a battle of penetration along a single line. He had speed and cohesion. Fira and Otmotsu. The Shigeki were simply a ruse, a brilliantly monstrous sacrifice, a way to scatter the Enrithi across the broken plains. Too much conviction, the wily old Sapatasha knew, could be as deadly as too little. A great ache filled Nayur's chest. Only Kellis's strong grip saved him the humiliation of falling to his knees. Always the same. Never had he been so conflicted. Never had he been so confused. Throughout the battle, while the others had gawked, exclaimed, and pointed, General Martimus had watched the Skilvendi and Prince Kellis, straining to hear their banter. The barbarian wore a harness of polished scale, the sleeves hacked short to reveal his many scarred forearms. A leather girdle set with iron plates strapped his stomach and waist. A pointed Kianin battle cap, its silvering, chipped in innumerable places, protected his head. Long black hair whipped about his shoulders. Martimus could have recognized him from miles distant. He was Skilvendi Filth. As impressive as he'd found the man both in council and in the field, the outrage of a Skilvendi, overseeing the holy war in battle, was almost too much to bear. How could the others not see the disgusting truth of his heritage? The man's every scar argued his assassination. Martimus would have gladly sacrificed his life to avenge those the savage had butchered, Why then had Confess ordered him to murder the other man standing next to the Skilvendi? Because, General, he's a Kisharum spy. But no spy could speak such words. That's his sorcery. Always remember. No, not sorcery. Truth. As I said, General, that is his sorcery. Martimus watched, unmoved by the prattle around him. But no matter how mortal his mission, he couldn't ignore glory in the field. No soldier could. Drawn by shouts of genuine triumph, Martimus turned to see the heathen's entire center collapse. Across miles, from Anrarat to the southern hills, Shigeki formations crumbled and scattered westward, pursued by charging ranks of Nansur and Thunyeri footmen. Martimus cheered with the others. For a moment, he felt only pride for his countrymen, relief that victory had come at so slight a cost. Confess had conquered again. Then he glanced back at the Skilvendi. He'd been a soldier too long not to recognize the stink of disaster, even beneath the perfume of apparent victory. Something had gone catastrophically wrong. The barbarian screamed at the horsemen to signal the retreat. For a moment, those about Martimus could only stare in astonishment. Then everything erupted in tumult and confusion. The Tidoni Thane, Ganriki, accused the Skilvendi of treachery. Weapons were drawn, brandished. The deranged barbarian kept roaring at them to peer south, but nothing could be seen for the dust. Even still, the violence of the Skilvendi's protestations had unsettled many. Several began shouting for the hornsmen, including Prince Kellis. But the Skilvendi had had enough. He barreled through the astonished onlookers and leapt onto his horse. Within heartbeats, it seemed, he was racing southeast, trailing a long banderole of dust. Then the horn sounded, cracking the air. Others started running to their horses as well. Martimus turned back, looked to the three men Confess had given him. One, the towering black-skinned Zayumi, met his eyes, nodded, then glanced past him to the Prince of Atrathau. They would run nowhere. Unfortunate, Martimus thought. Running had been his first truly practical thought in a long time. For a heartbeat, Prince Kellis caught his look. His smile held such sorrow that Martimus nearly gasped. Then the prophet turned to the distances seething beneath his feet. Vast waves of Kianine horsemen, their corselets flashing from their many-colored coats, charged down the slopes and slammed into the astonished Einani. The forward ranks, hunched behind their shields, struggled to brace their long spears on the incline, while above them, scimitars flashed in the morning sun. Dust swept across the arid slopes, horns brayed in panic. The air thundered with shouts, rumbling hooves, and the pulse of Fainum drums. More heathen lancers crashed into and through the Einani ranks. The tributary Sansori, under Prince Garsa Hadutha, were the first to break, scattering before none other than fierce Kinganjahoy himself, the famed Tiger of Umarna. Within moments, it seemed, the grandees of Umarna were pounding into the rear of the forward phalanxes. Soon, every phalanx on the Einani left, with the exception of the elite Kishati under Palatine Soter, was either stranded or routed. Withdrawing in order, the Kishati fought off charge after charge, purchasing precious time for the Einani knights below. The whole world, it seemed, was obscured by wind-drawn curtains of dust. Stiff in their elaborate armor, the knights of Keryati, Hinant, and Mozarothu, Antinamera, Eschalus, and Eschenex thundered up the slopes, charging through the thousands who fled. They met the Fainim in an ochre haze. Lances cracked and horses shrieked. Men cried out to the hidden heavens. Swinging his great two-handed mace, Uren Yanka, Palatine of humid Mozarothu, upended heathen after heathen. Sepharathindor, Count Palatine of Hinant, led his painted knights on a rampage, hewing men like wood. Prince Garsa Hadutha and his Sansori stalwarts continued charging forward, searching for the holy standards of their kinsmen. The Kianine horsemen broke and fled before them, and the Einani bellowed in exultation. The wind began to clear the haze. Then Garsa Hadutha, several hundred paces ahead of his peers, stumbled into Crown Prince Fenile and his Koyori. skewered through the eye socket, the Sansori prince crashed from his saddle and death came swirling down. Within moments, all 643 knights of Sansor had been either unhorsed or killed. Unable to see more than several paces, many of the Einani knights below simply charged the sound of battle, vanished into the saffron fog. Others milled about their barons and palatines, waiting for the wind. Horse archers appeared on their flanks and to their rear. Serwe huddled, racked by sobs, struggling to cover herself with her blanket.
"What have I done?" she bawled. "What have I done to displease you?"
A haloed hand struck her, and she slammed against the carpets.
"I love you,"
she shrieked.
"Kalos!"
The warrior prophet laughed.
"Tell me, sweet, sweet Serwe, what have I planned for the Holy War?"
The Swazan standard leaned in a gust, the bolts of white billowing and snapping like sails. Martimus had already resolved to kick the abomination to the ground afterward. Everyone had abandoned the hillock, save himself, Prince Kellis, and Confis's three assassins. Though more dust than ever plumed along the southern hills, Martimus could see what had to be Einani infantry fleeing the pale clouds. He'd long since lost sight of the Skilvendi across the broken pasture. To the west of the looming disaster, he could see the columns of his countrymen reforming. Soon, Martimus knew, Confis would have them marching double time toward the marshes. The Nansur were old hands when it came to surviving Fainim catastrophes. Prince Kellis sat with his back to the four of them, his feet sole to sole and his palms flat upon his knees. Beyond him, men climbed and toppled from fortress walls, lines of knights galloped across dusty pastures, northmen axed hapless Shigeki to the ground. The prophet seemed to be listening. No, bearing witness.
"Not him," Martimus thought. "I cannot do this."
The first of the assassins approached.